Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. For the first hour of the program today, we'll go to the Focus Archives. This is a show that we first broadcast in March. So as you listen to this first hour of Focus 580, do keep in mind that we will not be taking your calls. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with someone who has been a leader in the environmental movement now for over 30 years. His name is James Gustav Speth, and he's dean of the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale. He was co-founder of the Natural Resources Defense Council. He chaired the President's Council on Environmental Quality under President Jimmy Carter. He was president and founder of the World Resources Institute. He acted as a senior advisor to President-elect Bill Clinton's transition team, and he oversaw the UN Development Program as its chief executive officer. In his new book, The Bridge at the End of the World, he writes that while the environmental community has grown in strength, the environment has continued to deteriorate. He writes, "All we have to do to destroy the planet's climate and leave a ruined world to our children and grandchildren is to keep doing exactly what we are doing today." In this part of the program, we'll talk about some of his ideas, and he certainly makes the argument that there are a number of serious environmental issues that confront us, and to deal with them, we're going to have to take a different kind of approach than we've done in the past, something that is more dramatic and somebody, I suppose, some people might say was on the radical side. The Bridge at the End of the World, Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability is published by the Yale University Press. It's out now, so you can look for it in the bookstore. You might also look for a previous book, that book, Red Sky at Morning, America and the Crisis of the Global Environment, and that was published in 2004. And he was good enough to be with us on the program to talk about that book then, and we're pleased to have him with us now, joining us from Yale. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 for you here in Champaign-Urbana where we are, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. That's the toll-free line, and anyone listening to us over the air around Illinois, Indiana, or around the country, if you're listening on the Internet, you may use that toll-free line. Dr. Speth, hello.
Hi, David. Good morning.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Well, I'm delighted to be back, and I appreciate this opportunity, and the only thing I would say initially is that you're not the first person to refer to the book as The Bridge at the End of the World, when in fact it's The Bridge at the Edge of the World, and I think I may have mistyped the book.
Well, my apologies. I guess that would be a natural sort of mistake to make, especially on a Monday morning. So, yes, let's make sure that it is indeed The Bridge at the Edge of the World.
And thank you very much.
And available at bookstores near you. It's very clear that you feel that we are at a very important point here, perhaps a turning point as far as the environment is concerned, and that you are worried. You write in the book, in fact, that you are worried, and that if we don't do something, what's going to happen? I mean, what really is the worry about the point where we are now?
Well, I do think we're at a critical moment. What we have are a series of huge environmental threats, really, that have accumulated, and that we've been dealing with very inadequately. I think people are well aware now of the problem of climate change and global warming. We've continued to lose the world's tropical forest at a rate of about an acre a second, and half of the forest and the tropics and the temperate zones are now gone. Probably 90% of the large predator fish in the oceans are gone. We're fishing about 75% of the ocean's fisheries to capacity or overfishing them. Now we're consuming about half of the accessible fresh water that we can get our hands on, and that's skyrocketing and going up to 70% quickly. About half the wetlands are gone, a fourth of the corals. We're extinguishing species at about 1,000 times the normal rate, and not to mention all the problems with toxic chemicals in our society. So this is these problems have grown. We think we've sort of solved the environmental problem in a lot of ways because they're not as acute and obvious as it used to be. But the fact is that we're on the verge of ruining the planet, and all we have to do is just keep doing what we're doing today, and we will leave our grandchildren ruined world. Look at the trends, there's no doubt about it.
And I think it's probably worth mentioning there that to make sure that people know that what we're talking about, when you say all we have to do is to keep doing what we're doing, you're talking about, in large part, you're talking about how it is that we, and I mean collectively all of us, we in the industrialized world live. An additional issue here is that if we, you know, metaphorically speaking, look in our rearview mirrors, there are a lot of people that are behind us, but they're starting to catch up in terms of consumption, use of resources, and production of waste. And there, the issue becomes even more acute as those people get closer and closer to our levels of consumption, resource use, and production of waste.
I think people are seeing that in China now, very obviously. A new coal-fired power plant every week being constructed. I was just talking to this morning, actually, to a senior advisor to the Chinese government, and I asked what's the most important thing that can be done. And he said to me, the most important thing that can be done is for those of you in the rich industrial world to set the right example, to provide the right model, and for us, and indeed the book is really aimed at the affluent world and what we ought to be doing. And basically, you know, I've been in the environmental area and working in this field for close to 40 years now. And, you know, my conclusion at the end of this period is that the types of approaches that we've been pursuing won't get the job done. They haven't for 40 years, and they won't in the future. And trying harder won't make the big difference that we need. The truth is that we're working in a system that's inherently destructive of environment. It's a growth at all cost, profit motive, ensuring environmentally dishonest prices to the extent that we're running a market economy that doesn't reflect environmental realities and it's in effect out of control from in an environmental sense. Government desperately promoting growth for a variety of reasons, corporate power ensuring that there's very little real regulation and control going on, our own pathetic capitulation to consumerism and our hyperventilating lifestyles, and now the system is enormously large. It's four times as big as it was the world economy when I went off to college, and it'll be four or five times as big as it is today by the middle of this century. Hmm. So we've got to step outside of the system and start challenging some of these things if we want to deal with these issues.
Well, you talked about those things that we might call leading environmental indicators. You listed some of them, and in the book you talk about these eight major global scale challenges: the climate disruption, loss of forest, desertification, losing fresh water, marine fisheries, and so forth. And of course, all of those things, we could talk for some time about any of those things, and we've certainly talked about those things before on this program. But the central issue, the one that you just touched on, and that is the economic system that we have and the kind of values that are tied to it, that's the central issue here, that's what you would argue, and that's the thing that we're going to have to change. Now, you have also said that there are a number of kinds of potential responses to the problems that we've talked about, but it seems that the chief one that we've taken on, at least I think you would argue that those people who actually have influence in the world, relies on that same system, in a sense. It's a market solution to problems that the market seems to have created.
Well, we have a market that is there's nothing wrong with a market economy up to a point, but we have a market that's that really is running on dishonest prices, and we are very, very reluctant to have prices increase on any thing. Just imagine gasoline as a leading example. And yet we are underpricing things that are destroying the environment and, in effect, robbing our children and grandchildren of an opportunity to have a decent planet to live on. And so we've got to make the market work for the environment. In effect, right now, we're deeply subsidizing environmental destruction. deeply subsidizing it because we are pricing things far too cheaply. And we're also so committed to economic growth as the solution to all of our problems, our source of well-being and happiness. And all the studies that I've been looking at and reflected in the book suggest that that this growth that we've had in recent decades, very high levels of economic growth, has not really been translated into better lives for the American people. Real wages haven't been going up, in fact, and for decades now, since World War II, the level of human happiness and satisfaction with life in our country really hasn't increased. So, you know, what's it all about? Its growth is coming at an enormous cost to us environmentally, and we need a different approach. We need to step back and take a very different approach to dealing both with our social issues, which desperately need to be attended to, and to our environmental issues. But throwing more and more aggregate GDP growth at these problems is not the way to solve them. Growth is not the way to grow.
Let me again introduce the guest for anyone who might just have tuned in, James Gustav Speth. He is the Dean of the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale University and has been an environmentalist, someone who has worked in this area for a number of years. He is the author of several books. His newest is entitled The Bridge at the Edge of the World: Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability, published by the Yale University Press. Also, you might be interested in looking at an earlier book that was a book that was focused on the problem of global warming. That book is Red Sky at Morning. Questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let me give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about the environmental movement. And you certainly have some criticisms for the way that it's gone, the people in the movement have gone about doing what they do. Before that, maybe, is it possible to point to some successes? I'm sure that you would say that, in fact, the environmental movement has achieved some success.
Oh, I shudder to think what the world would be like if we hadn't had the modern environmental movement since about 1970 and the accomplishments that have come to pass as a result of that. The air is better. The water is better in our country, for example. We've put into wilderness an area about the size of California. But these are very partial victories, I would say, very partial victories. And even in our own country, if we, you know, move away from the global scale issues like climate change that we've been talking about and just focus on things like air and water pollution, where we've had some of the strongest programs, half the lakes and a third of the streams still don't meet the fishable and swimmable standard in the Clean Water Act. It was supposed to be met by 1983. A third of the public lives in counties that don't meet the air quality standards that EPA has set. Our energy use is just totally out of control. We're consuming as much oil as Japan and Germany and Russia and India and China combined now. And we're dumping vast amounts of toxic chemicals into the environment. And of something that most people, I don't think, are aware of, we're losing 6,000 acres a day of open space in the United States. Here's an interesting statistic. Mm-hmm. A few decades ago, there was nothing that the self-storage industry didn't exist. But now, despite the fact that our lot sizes have gone up dramatically and our house size is up 50% in the last few decades, that is not big enough to store all of our stuff. So we've now created this self-storage industry, and the square footage of that industry, if you could concentrate it, would cover the entire island of Manhattan and city of San Francisco combined. So we're just drowning in stuff, and a third of the species in the country are threatened with extinction. And we're not dealing at all with our population issue. There's just so even if you just focus on the more traditional at-home issues, the environmental movement, despite all of its efforts and its growing strength and sophistication, is not solving environmental problems. And that's the paradox that I wanted to address in the book. How mm-hmm. can we build, how can we have a stronger and stronger environmental concern and still see the environment going downhill? And my conclusion is that we're trying to work within a system which will not let us succeed. We're playing a loser's game, and it's time to – we're swimming upstream in a current which is too strong. And as we get stronger, it gets stronger because more and more growth is coming at us, more and more economic activity, more and more complexity, more and more problems. And we can't make the progress that we need to make in the system. We need to change the system.
Well, let's talk with someone who is listening. We have our first caller, and they are in Champaign and on line one. Hello.
Yes, sir. I just came in, and you say we need to change the system from the regulatory system we have now. How would you suggest we change the system to get more in a more effective and efficient manner of controlling pollution and managing waste?
Well, first off,
and of course, global warming. I forgot that now.
Sure. I think there are several things that we need to do. One is that we've got to stop subsidizing environmental destruction. And that means things that are environmentally destructive need to be very expensive. Right now, they're cheap, basically. And so the market is working on the wrong signals, and we're all being misguided and misled, in effect. Secondly, I think it's time to challenge this growth mania in our society. We need to move to a post-growth society. There's no evidence that all of the growth that we've had is actually benefiting, dealing with our social issues. Multinational corporations have taken 2 million jobs out of the United States in the early years of this century. And so we need to deal with these social issues, a growing disparity in our country between the rich and the poor and the loss of our jobs. We need to deal with these issues, but there's no evidence that growth itself is going to deal with these issues. And we need to challenge the power of corporations and the way corporations are chartered. Right now, corporations operate solely for the benefit of their shareholders, and that's required by law, in effect, and also required by our financial system, which puts such a premium on shareholder value and growth of profits. But basically, we need to, in effect, challenge that system and to recharter corporations so that all of the stakeholders have a right to participate in the governance of the corporation and have an opportunity to benefit from its wealth creation. And we need to change ourselves. We are so much a part of the system with such materialism and consumerism in our lives. Now, these are hard things to do, right? Nobody would ever think that any of those things is easy. I just think they're necessary, and that if they seem like a bridge too far today, wait until tomorrow, because these ideas that look difficult will become much more attractive as the future unfolds, because we're headed into a very, very bad situation unless we change and adopt some very far-reaching measures, actually.
I agree with you. I want to add one more question to this very difficult calculus you just espoused, and that is the politicians. How do we instill within them the political will to adopt your system, which I do agree with you needs adoption, especially if I think they're beholden to many of the corporations, the way we finance the political landscape in this country? That's my question.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think the political system is broken. I think our democracy is shallow and weak, the best democracy money can buy right now. So, to me, we need to start working on political reforms. I think the environmental community has sort of written off the whole political reform area and left it to groups like Common Cause, groups I greatly admire, but we need the environmentalists are never going to succeed within the politics of today, corporations are not only the major economic actors in our system, they are the major political actors. in our system. So if you ask me what's the one critical thing that we need right now, we need a movement, a grassroots movement in our society that can force the politicians' hands. It's a movement which would come about as a fusion of people who are concerned about the environment, who are concerned about jobs and social justice, and who are concerned about the quality of our democracy, and religious organizations, young people, scientists, average citizens who share these concerns have got to come together and build a grassroots movement in our country that can force these changes.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. It seems that since we have for such a long time measured our well-being in economic terms, particularly with something like gross domestic product, and we've used that then also as a way of comparing our well-being with that of other countries, how do you get away from this attitude about growth that seems very firmly entrenched?
Well, it is entrenched. It's hard to imagine anything that we are coached on and counseled on and talked to, preached about more than growth. But I was intrigued by your commercial, if you will, for your Friday AM program that I heard right before we came on the air, mm-hmm. where you focus on stories and you focus on the joy of life, laughter, love. I remember I wish we could replay that little commercial because I think that's the fundamental change that has to happen. I think people need to step back from our frenetic lifestyles, the materialism of our culture, and focus on those things that you talk about on Friday morning on that show, because these are the things that really matter. And statistics show that we've so disconnected from our families, our communities. A third of the people in the country say they have nobody to go to talk about a serious problem when they have one. We have tremendous community disintegration. The indicators of social well-being in our country, alcoholism and drugs and wages and unemployment and other things haven't really improved for decades despite all the growth. So I think people are ready for something new. I think people are ready for something better than the very all these manufactured lifestyles that we, identities that we manufacture out of advertising. We are ready for something better. We deserve something better. We can build something better.
We're at our midpoint here. Our guest is James Gustav Speth. He's dean of the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale, has been involved in the environmental movement for more than 30 years. He co-founded the Natural Resources Defense Council. He chaired the President's Council on Environmental Quality under President Jimmy Carter. He was president and founder of the World Resources Institute. He acted as a senior advisor to President-elect Bill Clinton's transition team, and he also oversaw the United Nations Development Program as its chief executive officer. If you're interested in reading some of his ideas, you could look for his new book, The Bridge at the Edge of the World, Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability. That's the subtitle. The book is published by the Yale University Press. We have a couple of callers here. We'll just keep on talking with folks, and the next person is in Oakland, and this is line two.
Hi.
Hello. Yes.
I couldn't agree more that we need to have a major change in attitude towards what's important and what's not really important. But I wonder if you could address the issue of population. It seems to me that population pressures are at the root of a lot of problems, from environmental to social to natural disasters. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Well, they certainly are. The population pressures are enormous in many places. I want to talk for a second about both the population issues in the developing world, where growth is still enormous, and the population issues in the United States. In the developing world, we need to do a lot more to provide family planning services, maternal and child health care services, employment for women, education for girls. When you put that package together, you see fertility rates go down, and we desperately need to be putting a lot more energy and effort into those programs and international support for local efforts in these areas. If we do, it's possible that we could see global populations level off below 9 billion people. Now that's 2.5 billion people, which is a huge additional load. But it's a lot better than having population continue to grow indefinitely. In the United States, we have neglected the population issue severely, and those of us who think of ourselves as progressives have got to find a way to talk about this issue without becoming identified with vigilantes on our southern border. Very few of us want to go there, but still we've got to deal with the issue. We're the third largest country in the world in terms of population, and population growth in the United States, by mid-century we'll add another 150 million people to our society at current rates. So I think we, and this puts, and each one of us is an enormous environmental burden on the planet. So we need to do that. I make a little joke and say that, which is a true story, that my wife and I were very much part of the Stop It 2 movement. You may remember that in the 1970s, which would be very good to bring back. And then we had our third child. But we need to bring back this this educational effort and basically, talk to each other about this problem.
Let's talk next with someone in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. A minor comment and a major one. The minor comment is you've mentioned several times that in order for us to get where we want to go, that many things that we buy in our ordinary life need to become more expensive. And I think that terminology will make it a very hard sell, what we want to do is to have the prices of things more nearly reflect their true cost. And I think that people would be readier to understand that than just that things should become more expensive. The major comment, while I was waiting on the phone here, the previous caller put forth what I think is an extremely important part of this, and as you have said, the modern environmentalists tend to have forgotten about population, but it is the most basic factor in all of this. And I was very pleased to hear the things that you said in response to her inquiry. And I would just add one aspect. Here in the United States, as a result of the two will do and associated things 30 or 40 years ago, the United States actually has achieved zero population growth. The reason that is not reflected in the population figures is because of immigration and the higher fertility of the new immigrants. The larger problem that this reflects, in my view, is that in order for a population to be controlled as it must be, the countries that have achieved zero population growth must understand that they should not encourage or allow the excesses from the countries that have not achieved it to be dumped upon them, because to the extent that that occurs, it relieves the countries that are still producing too many people from the feedback effects that would cause them to exercise effective control. And as you have said, the progressives in this country have a lot of trouble dealing with this issue, and most of them that I know are on the wrong side of it. They think that immigration is great and we ought to help the immigrants and there ought to be more of them because the ones that come here then can have a better life. In the short run, that's true, but it seems to me in the long run, that's false, and that somehow we've got to turn our thinking around.
Well, on the first issue that you raised, perhaps it is. It does sort of smack people in the face to talk about things being more expensive. That's the truth, but you're absolutely right that a more palatable way to express that would be to talk about making things you know, reflect their true costs than having environmentally honest prices. I agree with that, but the reality is that we're going to have to, in effect, have a public education effort to make people appreciate the need to get the prices right. You used the phrase, which I don't think I actually used, didn't intend to, referring to population as the most basic factor. It is a factor, definitely, but in my judgment, it's not as big a factor as our commitment to the economic expansion that we've had. We tend to forget. People don't want to deal with the fact that economic activity is inherently destructive of environment. For a period, it can be more or less so. It can be much less so for a period. But in the end, you can't have this enormous expansion of economic activity and not expect the environment to go downhill. And indeed, that has been the pattern so far, as one would expect. So I think the bigger problem than population growth is economic growth, which of course population growth feeds. But we could destroy the planet. We could ruin the planet with the current number of people without any trouble whatsoever. Just keep doing what we're doing today with the current number of people, and it would be ruinous down the road.
I want to thank the last caller, and I hope you wouldn't mind if I move on. The lines are full, and I want to try to get in as many callers as possible. Next, we'll go over to Belgium, not too far away, in Vermilion County, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to be a little bit more negative than probably what some folks are. I'm sure your guest and Mr. Inge and myself are all of the age that we can remember when the population of the United States was probably 150 million, maybe even a slightly less. Now it's about 300. And you yourself just mentioned that by mid-century it may very well be 450 million. Now, allow me to give you the example of what's probably going to transpire here. If you think of this situation as a petri dish, you have your culture, you soon put a little item in there to start growing, and it'll keep growing and multiplying, getting bigger and bigger, until finally it reaches the limits of its closed system. And it dies. The animal that's there doesn't really die. It just stops growing and ceases to increase. And that's exactly what we're going to do. We're finally going to reach the point that our closed system that we live in, no matter how people might think how large the Earth is, it is a closed system. And we will reach the point at which we can no longer expand. And at that point, a lot of us are going to not be here anymore. And that a lot of us that's not going to be here are not you and me. It's going to be our grandkids, our great-grandkids, or our great-great-grandkids, whoever it is. They'll cease to be. Now, maybe in the long run, that's the best solution to the problem.
Well, I hope not, and I'm sure you don't.
No, I don't.
Wish for that either. I think the long before we reach some absolute limit, we will reach other limits. And I think one that's bearing down on us very rapidly now is the prospect for truly disastrous climate change. There are many very credible scientists who think that we are fast approaching a tipping point on the climate issue where we could push the planet's climate into a disastrous regime. In fact, we could warm the place up so much that the warming would be self-reinforcing, self-stimulating, and we wouldn't even have to put additional greenhouse gases in the atmosphere to continue the warming. We would get these so-called positive feedbacks in the system where the planet just warms itself. And the types of things that could happen in terms of ecosystem destruction, in terms of sea level rise, in terms of the spread of disease-causing vectors, and a host of other things are really horrendous. And as I think many people are becoming aware, the amount of sea level rise that's that the melting or loss of the ice on Greenland and Antarctica, where we just had another huge break of a of an ice shelf, there are you know, perhaps 15 yards of sea level rise sitting on these land masses, and should somehow some significant portion of that make it into the oceans, we could have disastrous sea level rise, and we've already seen unprecedented changes in these polar regions. So they had a very serious sort of problem coming at us, you know, very soon if we don't change.
If I might point out slightly, sir, that even no matter how horrid we may treat our planet, okay, and I'm not for it at all, no matter how horrid we treat our planet, we will not destroy life. Something will come after us. It may not be us. It may not look like a dinosaur. It may not look like a whale. But we are not strong enough to totally destroy it. It's much larger than we are. Maybe that's the direction we have to go. Thank you very much.
You may be right about that, but that's sort of poor consolation, I would say.
Let's talk again with another call. This would be in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm disturbed about what I see right here in central Illinois, and that is this development of the most fertile farmland, I think some of the most fertile farmland in the whole world. And Urbana is expanding, Champaign's expanding, out buying, putting buildings on this prime farmland. Yet the inner city is tending to deteriorate, where I personally think that some of this development should take place. So I'm going to hang up and listen on the radio.
All right.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mentioned earlier that we're losing 6,000 acres a day of open space, of land in our country. We're losing prime farmland about twice as fast as other lands. And with that is the loss of not only visual amenities and places that people find beautiful and attractive to be in, but a tremendous loss of natural habitat. We're losing 100,000 acres of wetlands in our country every year. There needs to be a new consciousness about the loss of our land, and I think people are ready for it. There's some wonderful, evocative books and stories about the place you love is gone, for example, but we're in a system where it's growth at all cost, no matter what the cost is. And we really have to attack that and change it. And I hope the good people in your community will organize themselves to fight this, or it will be destroyed. It has been in so many places.
Seems to me that the kind of change in values that you're talking about, that there are a lot of people, I expect a lot of people listening, and some of the ones we've heard from are ready. They're already there. They're with you. And that the big question, or one of the big questions, is how do you, one would say, changing individuals' worldview is great. But the question is, how do you then institutionalize that?
Ah, good question. Can you have a social conversion experience rather than just an individual one?
Yeah.
That's a big issue. I asked a lot of psychologists and even some psychiatrists that question, and one answer came back more than any other, and that is, a catastrophe will change the way people view things, a calamity that affects people, and that seems to be one. So in effect, what we sort of have to hope for is a virtual catastrophe, a catastrophe that we can bring people to see what's happening without it really what could happen without it really actually happening. Or, you know, if we don't do that, we will hopefully have some foreshocks and short of the, you know, major catastrophe. So, you know, much as we could have learned a great deal about Hurricane Katrina, for example, that we didn't learn, things of that type could teach us some big lessons and make us wake up before it really is too late. If we have foreshocks, for example, in a time of wise leadership, and leaders are able to explain the problem to us and deal with the issue in a way that resonates powerfully with our traditions and values and points positively to a new future and a better way of doing things, I think these can be major opportunities to change consciousness and change our values.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with James Gustav Speth. He's dean of the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale, longtime participant in the environmental movement. His most recent book is The Bridge at the Edge of the World. You can find it in the bookstore now, I'm sure, published by the Yale University Press. We have two other callers. We'll try to accommodate them in the time that remains. Next is someone in Urbana, line two. Hello? Yes?
I recently saw, I think it was a NOVA thing where they were talking about solar, basically, and Germany has some goal set of 20% renewable by 2020, and at the rate they're going, they actually expect to hit 30%. I guess I'm wondering, I don't see anything happen in this country federally, but I'm wondering, like, in terms of states, if this is something that could be done here. I think Illinois has some kind of subsidy of solar, the initial expenses. And could that be done here?
Well, solar energy is absolutely essential to the future. And the good news is that it's growing very rapidly. Indeed, it's growing very rapidly in our country. You're right. The European Union has set a goal of 20% solar by 2020, solar in the largest sense of all the renewable energy sources. But the good news at home is that there are many, many states now who have set renewable energy goals for the particularly for the electrical utilities in the in those states. So we have tremendous growth in this area. There's tremendous potential. In general, to relate it back to the larger issues we were talking about, I think there's technology out there to do things so much better than what we're doing in almost all sectors of our society, in buildings, in energy generation, in energy efficiency, in transportation. So you have to ask, you know, how do we really drive technological change in a way that we haven't done that yet? And I think the way to do it is, of course, to, you know, put huge economic incentives in favor of change so that the prices of doing things the wrong way, the old way, are expensive or high, and their subsidies that are supporting doing things in a new way. Because we need, you know, enormously rapid technological change to deal with these issues. But we also need basically to slow up our lives, our economy, this frenetic push for growth at all costs if we're going to see that happen.
We'll get at least one more caller. This is also someone in Urbana, line one. Hello?
Is it my turn?
Yes.
Yes, I agree with you. I think the world's in a mess, and I'm just wondering what's going to happen to my children in the next 50 years. And I also recently heard three things. That number one is that wolves have been taken off the endangered species list, so I'm afraid there'll be no time till they're killed. And then the other thing I heard was that any buffalo that wander outside of Yellowstone Park are killed by the cattlemen. And then the third thing I heard was the Klamath River, which was a salmon river. All the salmon have been killed because the farmers took all the water out of the river to irrigate.
All of these things are results of the prioritization of giving primacy to economic values, to growth, to the economy, and we'll keep having these types of examples if we continue with that pattern. You have children. I have grandchildren. I was just with them. I worry a lot about them, and that's one reason I wrote this book. And 90% of the book is about the things that we do need to change. Right now, we have a cold and broken hallelujah. I mean, this should be the time of celebration. There's enough wealth in our society, and there's tremendous opportunity to enjoy life and seek fulfillment in ways that really do matter. But we careen from crisis to crisis instead in our economy, in our personal lives, in our communities, in the globe. It's time the citizens step up and take back the system before it really hollows out our politics and our communities and our nature.
I have to tell you, Dr. Speth, that we on this show have been talking about these kinds of things on and off for a long time. And if the comments that are made by callers are any indication of how people feel, there is a great deal of pessimism out there. People, I think they recognize these are important issues and feel that they're things that we have to grapple with. And I would hope that then in their own lives, they're trying to find some way to do that. But on the same time, there's this great doubt about whether as a society we can confront these things or not. Do you manage to have some kind of optimism about the future?
Oh, absolutely. I think we can't, I doubt if your listeners are giving up hope. That's the one thing we can't do. I think we have to look back. There was a moment in our history in the 60s with the Civil Rights Movement where we really accomplished something big and significant in the country, driven by people who were willing to take risks, who were willing to march. We need to bring back that spirit and apply it to this situation urgently.
We'll try and do one more caller here. It's someone in Champaign. Line two. Hello.
Yes. Well, of course, we all want to believe that populism is part of the solution. But what we're up against politically is private ownership, and there's no place that you can discover that more easily than at Yale or any of the other major private universities. There was a time when Yale's campus was very supportive of the kind of movement that you're talking about. That was back in the late 60s and 70s, and I don't know since then what the environment there is like. But I'll just give you one name, and that's Weyerhaeuser. He's an old Skull and Bones crony and the family, and that's an example of the power of private ownership. So I hope that you will, keep this spirit and idea going at Yale. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I do see a lot of hope and a lot of drive in today's young people. I've joined the board of directors of a group called One Sky, which is trying to mobilize a grassroots movement in the country to protect the global climate. It's driven by young people, and it's really inspiring to see. And I had taught a course here at the university last year on these issues, and had an overflow crowd of students in a huge auditorium. So I think there is. I look to the young people. I look to religious communities and people who are concerned about social justice to join with the sort of established environmental community and drive real change. But we need a movement. We need a movement. There's no doubt about it in my mind.
And you're not arguing, though, for a radically different economic system. You're not, for example, thinking that maybe socialism would be a better way to go.
I tell you, I talk about this in the book because I do think we have to move beyond today's capitalism, and so people say, well, that's nice, but what do you mean? And mm-hmm. I try to, and I do describe that in the book at length. But what I'm searching for, and what I think we should be searching for as a society, is a non-socialist alternative to capitalism as we know it. It does not involve, in my judgment, expropriation of private property or anything of that type. But it does involve some of the things that we've been talking about here, in effect, rechartering corporations, moving to a post-growth society, addressing our affluenza, and getting the market straightened out, mm-hmm. and building, dealing with this problem of social insecurity in our country. We have, half the people, half the families in the country are making less than $45,000 a year, and basically are just getting by. We won't deal with these issues until we deal with the problem of economic inequality and political inequality in our society. So the challenge is huge, but we've got to start.
We would recommend that if you're interested in reading some more on the subject, more of the ideas of our guest, James Christoph Spath, you look for his book, The Bridge at the Edge of the World, Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability. It's published by the Yale University Press. Our guest is Dean of the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale. And Dr. Spath, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, David. It's been a real treat to talk with your listeners.
Our thanks also to Phil Kearney, who's the engineer there at the other end of our connection there at Yale.